Hey y'all, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And today on the show, we're going to have Jeff Tucker back to talk about a couple of articles he's written at liberty.me. 11 p.m. Baghdad time. I think that's going to be too late for Roy. What did I say? It's 9:30. I think 9:30 Iraq time is the last spot I've got. Damn. Man, see, Roy Guttman. You know, I might even record one with him later this afternoon. I don't know. That's against my rules, man. I don't like doing that if I don't have to. Do a live radio show and then spend all afternoon recording them too? Damn. Maybe tomorrow. Roy Guttman from McClatchy Newspapers reporting from Baghdad, and he's got a piece, I lost it, it's around here somewhere, about politics breaking out in the parliament in Iraq, big story. Man, I really want to talk to them today about this. New Iraqi government named, but parliament delays vote on two ministers. Abadi's the prime minister, I think, or did they not get around to that? No, they did. They elected Abadi as prime minister, and then according to CNN this morning, they've got... Oh, this is important. I better get back to this in a second. According to CNN this morning, Nouri al-Maliki has gotten one of the vice presidency spots. So he is not gone. And, well, that's going to... That's going to be interesting because, of course, you know, he's been in power for a long time and has a lot of people that he's put in power all throughout the bureaucracy who are going to still consider him the leader, right? We'll see how that works. But then also, and this is something that Jonathan Landy was saying on the show on Sunday morning on KPFK, was that they're talking about bringing in Iyad Alawi. Now, Iyad Alawi, you might remember, is a Shiite, but he's a former Baathist, used to work for Saddam Hussein, and also used to work for the CIA as a truck bomber and turned against Saddam Hussein, and then was the American sock puppet dictator of Iraq from June 2004 till, I guess, right around 1 year later. I guess he didn't really give up power for Jafari until would have been the beginning of 2000 and oh yeah no that would have been right yeah because they wrote the new constitution in 04 and they had the election in January of 05. So yeah he was a dictator for about a year there under the American occupation after Paul Bremer went home. Anyway, Alawi, he and his coalition won the election of 2010. But Iran insisted that Maliki stay, and Obama agreed with them. And, you know, as George Bush, don't think that that's a partisan thing. Bush's policy was always to do whatever the Ayatollahs wanted in Iraq as well. So Alawi had won the election, but he lost anyway, and they kept Maliki. And it was a hell of a scandal back then, but he's been waiting in the wings. And the reason that this is big news is because at least the theory goes in the Western capitals, and maybe in Baghdad, that this guy, even though he's a Shiite, because he's a former Baathist, he knows the Baathists, and he knows a lot of the Sunni tribal leaders, and for whatever reason, he has their trust, certainly more than the Dawah Party or the Supreme Islamic Council or Muqtada al-Sadr or any of the other Shiite leaders. So the whole, you know, theory here, and this is what Obama's going to say in his big speech tomorrow, is that they're going to try to recreate the awakening movement, basically. Now that Maliki's gone, they're going to try to have this guy Abadi cut the Sunni tribal leadership in on so much of the spoils that they will turn against ISIS and, you know, just create a tribal government. In other words, recreate the so-called awakening of 2006. 2007, really. Well, the end of 06, beginning of 07. And so, yeah, I think there's a fat chance of that. As George Carlin pointed out, fat chance and slim chance mean the very same thing. Yeah. Not very likely. But I guess we'll see what happens. That's what they're trying to do here. And yeah, that's right. Tomorrow is Obama's big speech. This really is kind of like Rolling Start out of the Downing Street memos. Remember that? Well, option A is a big build-up in Kuwait and then a full-scale invasion. That's what they ended up doing, right, in 2003. Option B, Rolling Start. We'll dress up an American U-2 in UN colors and get it shot down over Iraq deliberately and then go ahead and call that a material breach of the UN resolutions and go ahead and start the bombing campaign early. And just get the damn thing going as soon as possible. And they decide, of course, on option A in that case. But this is like option B. Obama's been giving speeches and making statements and answering questions at press conferences about the situation in the Islamic State and Shiistan, and the land over there formerly known as Iraq and Kurdistan, and the land formerly known as Iraq, for months now. He announced back in June, not long, in fact, the same week after Mosul fell. 3-4 days later, he stood in front of the helicopter on the White House lawn and said, "We will not let them have a safe haven there. There will be no safe haven for terrorist groups in the whole Sunni Triangle." Oh, and Eastern Syria, too. Wowee. That's a pretty big promise. And you know what? You know, not to pat myself on the back too much about it or anything, but if you're a regular listener to this show, then you notice that I've been calling this for months, since before ISIS went back into Iraq, and, they were in Fallujah since the beginning of the year, but, you know, before the big full-scale sacking of Mosul and the declaration of the Islamic State, in the weeks leading up to that, go back to the archives and check, and I was interviewing Patrick Coburn about well, not just him, but basically every expert I can think of on modern day, you know, jihadist movements around North Africa and the Middle East. And in my conversation with Michael Scheuer, he was saying, yeah, Boko Haram, Boko Haram. And I said, yeah, they're getting to that. But I'm looking over here still at the land between Syria and Iraq, what's left of Syria and Iraq. They're already calling it the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And it's de facto, if it's not lawless territory, that's who rules it. And just all you have to do is use your imagination for a moment. It's not like I'm brilliant, but I just decided to pause and think about it. With all of the Assad must go, because that's what Israel wants, politics notwithstanding, over the medium term, over the short term, they cannot let there be a bin Ladenite Islamic State. Even if they created it to take Iran down a peg in Syria or whatever, still, they can't let it stay for a long time. They'll have to turn around and go to war against it. And then it also doesn't take much imagination to figure out that the Kurdish Peshmerga can't do it. And the Iraqi army, no. With just air support and, you know, special forces leadership, they're going to what? Take back Tikrit and Samarra? Or I guess, no, maybe they didn't lose Samarra. But they're going to take back Mosul, and they're going to take back all of northwestern Iraq, Fallujah. I don't believe that. It's going to take the U.S. Army, Marine Corps, if that's what they mean to do, and that's what they vowed to do. And it's true that Obama keeps, you know, changing the way he says it all the time. But what he means is, well, like the New York Times reports, we're going to be at war for, the plan now is for 3 years of war in Iraq to get rid of the Islamic State. How many years longer do you think it'll take than that to finish up there? Oh, George Bush was right. Left too soon. Should have just stayed forever in the first place. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and damn it, man, I don't know. After all this time and complaining about wars, I still ain't figured out how to stop one. You know, a year ago, the American people rose up and just said no. Conservatives may be as Jacksonian as can be about militarism, but with Obama at the reins of it all, not so much, you know? You know, give your boy to Barack Obama to go use up? Are you sure that that's the right thing? You don't trust him. Why would you let him lead your country in battle? Barack Obama, of all people. Conservatives? That's what you thought a year ago. And the liberals, you know, they did too. They stood up against it too. They said, Obama, we love you, but please don't go to war in Syria. Consensus, man. Consensus. Go back and do, in fact, add unanimous to your search terms, and you will find congressmen last summer, right at this time last summer, end of August, beginning of September, going to town hall meetings, and their constituents unanimously opposing intervention in Syria. Now, in that case, it's true that the proposal, the way it was spun, was we have to go and help these people because their government is so mean that it's using chemical weapons on them. And, you know, I don't know how well it really sank through, how well it really broke through the mainstream media narrative that the government, Obama, wanted us to side with the jihadist suicide bomber, prisoner decapitator rebels here a year ago. And, you know, there was a guy who said to McCain, you're a traitor, you want to help Al-Qaeda in Syria and whatever. So there were some people who were, you know, it was breaking through kind of on the right-wing fringe, right? Like on the in the WorldNet Daily, Michelle Bachmann theory of events where Obama is an Islamist and loves helping Islamists, which is a complete misunderstanding of the motivation, they were catching on to, geez, McCain and Obama both would have a side with the Sunni-based insurgency. We just finished fighting in Iraq for 5 years. So what the hell is that about? And then the other part of it, and I think this is a really big part of it, was they said, we have to go and help the people. It's a responsibility to protect. It's a humanitarian war. And, you know, chemical weapons, that crosses the red line. And I think really the consensus of the American people was, and I hate to say this because, you know, I'm from here, but I think if you go back and check the journalism at the time, it will reflect this, the poll data at the time. The American people's attitude was, we don't care enough about the Syrians to bomb them. We don't care enough about the Syrians to unleash Al-Qaeda on them, to destroy the state army that's keeping Al-Qaeda at bay. We don't care enough about them to protect them from being attacked with chemical weapons. Let them burn. Whereas this war is being spun as, look, everyone, evil enemy. Adolf Hitler. Gotta stop them before they conquer the world. Islamo-fascist caliphate. Yeah, okay, it's about 15,000 fighters, max. And they rule the crappiest part of Iraq. They make a few million dollars a day in oil sales, guys. Million. Like, not even tens of millions. Ones of millions. But this is why I was calling this war months back, too, is because I said that, look, you can't have a bin Ladenite state where this guy, I mean, Baghdadi might as well be bin Laden himself. Basically, he's a carbon copy up there, as far as Americans are concerned. Yeah, more or less, you know, realistically speaking. And so, what a perfect boogeyman. You can't, You can't not sell that. You tell the American people, look at this bad guy, and he's cutting off white American reporters' heads. And I only say it that way because, yeah, no, apparently that's the only thing that makes the news, because ISIS has been murdering journalists for a long time, most of them not white and American. And those guys don't seem to get much coverage. But anyway, as I've been explaining for months, just, you know me, the way I like to babble and think about stuff. These guys are fanatical lunatics. They like killing Shia because they like killing Shia. The worst thing that you could be to them is a Shia, and they'll kill you. That's their attitude. And it's their strategy, too. You know, Lawrence Wright wrote up a great thing in the New York, the New Yorker magazine blog on their website about ISIS's savage strategy. They are trying to foment, you know, decade-long, wide-scale, multi-faction civil war in the region. Hell yeah, that's what they are. They're fighters, and they want to fight. That's all they want. And so they're going around cutting people's heads off because they're trying to provoke reactions. Bring the Iranians in on the side of the Shia Iraqis even more so. That's perfect public relations from the point of view of the leaders of ISIS. By all means, bring in Iran. In fact, on CNN this morning, they showed a tribal leader saying, we'll break off our alliance with ISIS as soon as Iran leaves and stops supporting the Iraqi government, army, and militias, and Shia militias. Oh, then he'll stop supporting ISIS, huh? In other words, never, because America, George W. Bush, fought a 8-year war for Iran's stooges, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawah Party. And later, Muqtada al-Sadr, who started out Iraqi nationalist, but then they chased him into Iran and pushed him much closer to Iran and their interests after that. They hated him because he was anti-American as much as he was anti-Iranian, and that wouldn't do. They wanted to stay. But anyway, so if anybody thinks that Iran is going to stop supporting the Dawah Party or the Supreme Islamic Council, the Mahdi Army, the Bada Brigade, Brigade, break-off group of the Mahdi Army. No, that's not ever going to happen. That's the government of Iraq, of the land from Baghdad to Basra, Shiistan, George W. Bushistan. They're in alliance with Iran. And the more Iran gets in it, the more that just benefits ISIS by helping make this thing a religious war, a sectarian war. And, you know, for the Americans to get involved, it's so funny, man, to listen to this. You look at the New York Times and they go, oh, yeah, here it is. Destroying ISIS may take years, officials say. Yeah, it's a 3-year strategy. Well, it's going to take you 3 years to sack Mosul and Raqqa and drive these guys out of official power to turn them back into an insurgency? Or you're saying that after you're done with that, it's only going to take a couple of years to clean up the insurgency that's left over? Because what a lie is that? But meanwhile, what's the solution to this? Let the local Sunnis turn on them because they're jerks. As Patrick Coburn said, they're going around saying, turn over all the documentation on how old your daughter is. We might want to marry her. You think that's going to last? Come on. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here live weekdays at noon on the Liberty Radio Network. Our first guest on the show today. Oh, well, it looks like our only guest on the show today. That's all right. It's Jeff Tucker. He is the chief liberty officer of liberty.me, which you can sign up for at liberty.me.
Yes.
And he is also a distinguished fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education. Welcome back to the show, Jeff. How are you doing?
Fine. You know that I'm actually speaking to you from the offices of Fee in Atlanta right now?
I did not know that.
Yeah, no, it's a true story.
Oh, whoops.
So, yeah. So it's exciting to be here in both places. Like, online and offline.
Right. Well, good deal. Very happy to have you back on the show. And, you know, I've been talking about, well, not so much you, but this article that you wrote. I've been mentioning it on the show. The state is just not that into you. It was one particular point that I picked up on that I've been repeating was about what you say about the Oklahoma City bombing in here. But we could get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what a great article. And it reminded me, George Carlin said it in a lot more emphatic way that they don't care about you. They really don't. And the thing is it's so drummed into us that they do care about us, that that's their very reason for being this state at all, is because of how much they care about us.
Yeah.
That, and, you know, it really needs that kind of debunking all the time, doesn't
it? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So here's the thing, though. I think this has changed in my own living memory. You know, before 1995, I mean, maybe in the 1980s, there was a kind of plausibility to the idea that the public sector was kind of, you know, more or less working for the people. There wasn't such a huge fissure, you know, a vast chasm that separated the state from the people. Maybe that was an illusion in some sense, and I'm willing to grant that. But things have changed, you know, just dramatically. And in that article, what I did is I kind of reconstructed the modern history of how all this kind of came to being, starting with the Oklahoma bombing, which actually you can't really think about that subject without thinking about Waco too. So those are kind of linked together, but it's just been straight sort of downhill. And what you have, and I don't know if you want to go into the details of things, but the theory is that my idea here is that the Oklahoma bombing inspired a kind of paranoia among the public employees, that they began to kind of look at the rest of the population as their enemy, like people out to get them, you know? But that wasn't really true before. And so you began to kind of be treated like an enemy combatant or something, you know, when you go into a government building. And it was after that bombing that happened. Mm-hmm. And then the second great, of course, moment was 9/11. It was like, okay, so we're paranoid, but now the threat is real and everywhere and heavily militarized. And then my third great event, you know, was the financial crisis of 2008, where the state at all levels began to use its sort of paranoia and its newly militarized power to kind of extract revenue from the population that was otherwise being denied them thanks to the recession. So those are the great three stages that have created our current situation, where, I mean, there's kind of an ongoing cold war between government and the people that's alive today. And we all sense that. We know it.
Right. Yeah. Well, what a great article. Again, it's at liberty.me. The title is "The State is Just Not That Into You." And I think, you know, it's really important, those three points that you hit on there. And, you know, it's funny about the Oklahoma bombing. I don't know if you know, but I'm a total kook on the issue, and I think there was a massive cover-up. In fact, I know there was a massive cover-up of all of McVeigh's friends, because at the very least, they were all state's witnesses or flipped informants, you know, these type people who they compromised the federal cops as much as the federal cops had compromised them. And so there's a massive cover up. They blamed it on just the two guys. And and then again, it could have been worse than that. It could have actually been a sting operation. But the point that I wanted to make about it was, regardless of whether you think McVeigh did it, you know, for only his reasons and that's what counts, or if you think Andre Strassmeyer put him up to it and all of that, either way, the point is that the purpose of it was to alienate the people from the government. From McVeigh's point of view, being a neo-Nazi type fighting against the Zionist occupied government and whatever crap, he thought, look, the government's the enemy of the people, but they don't see that. So if I can make them really mad and get them to freak out and overreact and clamp down harder on people, then that's going to cause a war. That's the whole point of it. You're trying to act out the Turner Diaries and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the government will go out now and attack a bunch of Nazi and militia groups, then they'll all fight back and it'll be a revolution. That's what he was going for. It happened in much more minor or much like on a lower level kind of. But that's the point of terrorism, is to provoke that exact reaction that we got.
So I can't. I'm a little bit stunned, actually, Scott, that you know so much about this topic. I mean, I'm kind of interested. You know, I hadn't heard that name, Andre Strassmeyer, in so many years. But yeah, I mean, maybe you need to actually explain who he is. I mean, he was like a German national or something. He was like, and an actual neo-Nazi. He was hanging around the U.S. Am I right about this? But there's like a good chance that he was an agent provocateur, like actually on the payroll of the FBI, and then he vanished like soon after the bombing. Never to be heard from again. But he was all over. Like,
Tucker knows the story, yeah.
Yeah, am I right? Yeah, yeah. So he was like friends with...
In fact, let me go ahead and add this just because it's a great and recent footnote. There's a new book out called Oklahoma City, and it's published by a major publisher, and it's written by a major British reporter named Andrew Gumbel, and it's absolutely meticulous. There's nothing conspiracy theory about it. They did. You can watch on YouTube. They did a big seminar with Peter Bergen, the terrorism expert there at the New America Foundation, and it's approached from that kind of liberal democratic, very paranoid about the radical right point of view, which makes it acceptable in the mainstream. That let's take a little bit deeper look at who all McVeigh was working with on this thing. And almost uniformly, they were flip states witnesses or undercover.
Yeah.
You know, if not provocateurs, at least agents that made the government look really bad for this happening right under their nose kind of thing.
Can I ask you something, Scott? Have you actually read the Turner Diaries?
No, I have not. I know of it, but I have not read the book.
I'm just going to admit to you that I have.
Uh-huh.
And it was, and I, look, I do not recommend that anybody read this book, okay? So I think it's a ghastly and terrifying book, and it's a harrowing experience to read it, really. Mm. And I wish I never had, but I must say that that book gives you an insight into a kind of ideological structure that's alive, not just here in the U.S., but in Europe, too, which is a kind of national socialist, you know, sort of neo-Nazi, you know, neo-fascist ideological vision that's not left socialist. It's really right socialist, and it's murderous, genocidal, and totalitarian, and absolutely frightening at every level.
Yeah.
I mean, that book gave me an insight into something I wasn't entirely sure I understood. But after reading it, I now see it and I recognize it as an actual danger, you know, and not so much from the private, from militia groups, you know, that's an issue, but you know, states that adopt this sort of Turner Diaries ideology can also be enormously dangerous. I mean, it's an
very appealing to people. It always has been.
It is. You know, you're so right about that, Scott.
I mean, you're right that the guy I know, I used to hear the author of the Turner Diaries, Pierce was his name, used to buy Radio Time here in Austin, and talk about demented and hateful, and yet you could see how it's. Has a certain sound of credibility to it. It's got that kind of unified field theory explanation of everything that makes it sound very true to the simple mind. Anyway, hang on one second. We're talking with the great Jeff Tucker, liberty.me. Go sign up for it. Use promo code Scott, too. Hey, we'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day, is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal as we knew it is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. Me. In this case, liberty.me. Hey, I'm on there. I'm scotthorton.liberty.me. And Jeff Tucker is tucker.liberty.me.
That's it.
The state is just not that into you. And then also related, fascism is real and alive. We're talking about that too. And three big bullet points again for review here real quick on the first article. It's a chronology. The Oklahoma bombing that made the government fear the American people in such a crazy way, help really alienate our society from government society in this country. And then September 11th made Americans love them 1,000%, no matter what, no matter how much they hate us. You know, on the occasion of the government's greatest failure ever, their approval ratings and conviction ratings and every other kind of getting laid at the bar at night ratings and everything else went absolutely through the roof. And only just now finally beginning to come down from that, if at all. And then the 08 crash, very important, left the states desperate for what the people had left because they had built up their budget so big. And then without all the property tax revenue and sales tax revenue from the bubble coming in, they just decided to send out all their officers to eat out our substance, you know, just about to death. Which is, I guess, why they think they need those MRAPs, because they figure at some point we're going to get pissed off. Although, I don't know whether that's really true or not, but that seems to be the assumption there. But So that really brings us to the real point about fascism, because, and this is something that, you know, Charles Goyette wrote a whole book like this, Jeff, which is that, hey, when the real crash comes, the dollar crash, and we have the kind of financial crisis in America that makes 2008 look like a warm-up exercise kind of a thing, that's when we need desperately the ideology of freedom. Because when times are that uncertain and scary and hungry, people turn to demagogues. They turn to easy, violent answers. They turn to the right or the left, either way, to the doom of our society. You know, if we can't get it together, that what screwed everything up here was abandoning, you know, old little L liberalism, not the fact that we ever had it, you know?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. I think it's completely right. I've actually speculated in that article on fascism that sort of fascist ideology, which is really... it's not just a curse word, right? And this is the real deal. It's a systematic way of thinking. Well, it's not so systematic, but it's a kind of a coherent collection of biases and impulses. I think it's probably a greater threat to the U.S. today than anything that comes from the left. And the left is a threat, but you know, the bourgeoisie are drawn to fascism. They always have been. And I think it's pretty darn scary. And what's strange is that we don't have a nose for fascism, really. We don't really recognize it when it's in our midst, because we don't talk about it as a living ideology. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, earlier in the last segment we were talking about Turner Diaries. That's why I guess I'm kind of glad I read it, because it just gives you an insight into this mindset. It really is not a left wing kind of ideology. It's really right wing at its core in some ways. Fascism is a strange ideology, because it's not revolutionary like socialism, like left socialism. It leaves the institutions that the bourgeoisie really like in place, like private property. Clerical class is asked to participate in the grand state project. You know, there's no real fundamental attack on the family or sort of traditional values or anything like that. What it does is it reaches into the organic matter of the prevailing society and sort of centralizes it and militarizes it and puts it under a sort of a top-down control. You know, I mean, that's essentially the fascistic impulse. And I think as we've seen the rise of the total state in the U.S., that's sort of the form it's taken, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not sure whether to believe the poll, really, but I guess so. I take it at face value for argument's sake anyway, that you got super majorities of Americans who are willing to go back to war right now in Iraq. And they got to know on some level that it's the U.S., the last war there, that made the mess that now supposedly we got to go clean up. But fine. Give them a couple of beheadings on TV. Don't even need to attack our towers anymore. Hell, in Libya, they threatened that there was gonna be a massacre, right? Not even that there was a massacre, a genocide that had to be stopped, but just that there could be if we don't intervene. And at this point, the American people, you know, they're as for it as the Pentagon. Jeff?
What's your read, Scott? You follow this stuff so closely. I'm just really curious about that. What's your read on mainstream conservative opinion about this proposed war on ISIS?
Well, they want to blow up everything. I mean, they don't trust Obama to do a violent enough job of it. But for
so
them,
Obama,
you know, conservatives...
for pacifism here, right?
I'm sorry?
Obama's being criticized for being a pacifist, a secret pacifist. Is that right?
Right, yeah. He's yeah. dithering when what he needs to do is just carpet bomb them all off the face of the earth and this kind of thing. And then, you know, it's sort of like what you were saying about we don't have an honest discussion of fascism. We don't have an honest discussion of Iraq. We don't have anybody saying that, you know, our Army and Marine Corps fought these guys toe-to-toe on the ground with machine guns for 5 years, and they didn't eradicate them. They didn't eradicate them. At some point, they were able to bribe the locals to marginalize them, but then they came right back again, and then Obama helped them in Syria and turned this thing into 1,000 times the crisis it had to be. But if they had to use that as the premise for every discussion of going back to Iraq, we might have a little bit of a different poll. But instead, even after all this, history just started yesterday, and some bad people took over part of Iraq, and we got to go stop them, everybody.
Here's a beheading, depressing.
You know?
Yeah, and people just respond with emotion. To some extent, I wonder if this is a kind of a leftover from there's never been a consensus in this country about what happened in Vietnam, for example. I mean, you've got everybody kind of agrees it was a disaster, but on the right, you have this opinion that it was a disaster because we didn't just lay waste to the place.
They stabbed in the back, right.
You know, and then on the left, it's like, well, we never should have been at war in the first place. So, yeah, you sort of have the same feeling of now brewing about Iraq. It's like, well, this is just proof that we didn't use enough state power. There's never enough state power. You know, there's certain people who just think that that's the answer to everything. Anything goes wrong in the world, we just have to unleash hell. Is it your sense that Obama is being like more cautious than what public opinion would enable him to be? Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean,
are you happy about that, or what's your feeling?
Well, look, no, I wouldn't be happy unless he gave a big speech where he just said, look, you know what? The truth is, this is all American foreign policy's fault. And if we intervene now, all we can do is distort the local market for power even more and lead to more backlash and more consequences, just like when we gave Baghdad to the Shia, for crying out loud, over the last decade. And so now at this point, it's time to back off and let things settle out a little bit and see how they are. I mean, the truth is, these guys in ISIS are as bad as they say. It's probably the first time our enemy has been as bad as they say, you know, this whole time. But that's why the locals hate them, too. That's why everybody hates them. And that's why they're completely surrounded by enemies on all sides. They have more than half a dozen enemy groups all around them. And plus, they're ruling over people who they are totalitarians. And so the locals, they've rejected them before. There's every reason to believe they'd reject them in the past. And that the local solution would be the one that could be permanent. Right? Rather than something that Uncle Sam rigs that has to fall apart again, just like the Maliki government just fell apart, just like all the last schemes over the last decade fell apart. Anyway, I'm sorry, it's your interview, but...
Well, listen, you know, this stuff goes really back 25 years, you know? I mean, this whole Iraq nonsense began, you know, very soon after the Cold War ended, and with the Bush war on Iraq over that Kuwait oil business. So, you know, if the U.S. doesn't bear some responsibility for this, then it doesn't bear any responsibility for anything, you know? So you're exactly right about that. Yeah. This is a quarter century now we're going on here of this nonsense.
Right. Yeah, no let up in the Clinton years. People might be under that illusion. I know you're not, but just I like pointing that out.
No, that's right. It was going to continue on, you know, continuing sanctions and bombings and all the rest of it. And look, it's also important to remember that ISIS, these kinds of people, just in general, these are the successors to our allies in the later years of the Cold War. You know, so you know this is the Islamic radicals that were fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, and the U.S. at the time was saying these are our friends. You know, they're in favor of traditional values.
Right. Yeah. Hey, they're people of the book, man. That's what they call us.
People of the book.
Yeah. Hey, listen, is it okay if I keep you one more segment, Jeff? You got to run or what?
Yeah. No, we just started.
All right. Well, it's a long break, so put the phone down. We'll be back at 6 after. Jeff Tucker from Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014, at Columbia University. Sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Hey, we got an extra segment with Jeff Tucker. He's at liberty.me, of course. And so am I, actually. My profile is liberty.me/members/Scott Horton Show. Or I think there's another one is Scott Horton.liberty.me. That's the other one. That's the publishing site. There you go. Yeah. So, Jeff Tucker, he writes things. And in this case, the state is just not that into you. With a funny picture of a crying girl at a bar there from apparently a movie I've never seen. And I think I've heard of that, though. And then this other great article, fascism is real and alive. And in fact, I think your picture at the top here, kind of with all the people saluting there at some giant stadium. Oh, I guess that must be the Olympics in Nazi Germany there or something.
Yeah, it probably was that 1935, 38,
Like that to me is the perfect explanation of what you said earlier, why Americans, I think you said, we just don't have a nose for it. We don't know fascism when we're looking right at it. Mm-hmm. Of course, partly that's because the term is just so overused, but also mm-hmm. it's because all the pictures of fascism are in black and white, and everybody has mm-hmm. a weird salute that's different than our salute. And, you know, in fact, I was going to say, you know, we don't have the jackboots necessarily marching up and down the street, but yeah, we do. Although they're not in black and white footage, though.
I think the reason, I mean, this is a very interesting question. Like, why don't we use the word fascism? Is that me?
What happened?
Oh, that was me. I'm so sorry. That was a crazy website I had. So why don't we use this word in a sort of normal way, you know, to describe an actual ideology, and almost dispassionately, I think we should be able to use it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because of this impression that somehow we vanquished fascism from the world of World War II. You know, so because we won the war, fascism is gone, you know?
Right. And
that's the impression that people have, and so we don't have to worry about it anymore. But it's crazy because there are basically two branches of authoritarian statism in the world, the left and the right. And if we're only able to recognize one of those, you know, that's actually a serious problem. Mm.
Well, actually, as you mentioned in here too, though, part of the confusion is because it's not exclusively a right-wing phenomenon, as some usually right-leaning libertarians like to say, it's national socialism, so it's really a left-wing thing, and there is a little something to that fact.
There's a little truth to that. Yeah,
Jonah Goldberg, the neocon, wrote an article about how liberalism is fascism.
Yeah, okay, so here's the thing, Scott. I mean, this is complicated, and actually you can read about a lot of this in Mises' great book, 1922 book, Socialism. So even though it was written before national socialism became a threat to Europe, he actually mentions it in passing. But here's the thing. Like, Mussolini is, of course, the founder of fascism as we once knew it. And he grew out of a syndicalist tradition. But the critical thing to understand about fascism is that it made a name for itself and became a powerful force in world politics, not as somehow an extension of Marxism, but as an opposition to it. So fascism has always been anti-communist, for example. You know, that, and people turn to fascism to save themselves from communism, in the same sense that they turn to the New Deal to save us from socialism. And people turn to, you know, to Hitler to save themselves from, you know, Jewish communism, you know, in Germany. So it's always kind of positioned itself as an anti-left ideology, even though it kind of, I guess at its roots, kind of grows out of a syndicalist ideological firmament. So it's a complicated relationship. But there wouldn't be fascism. Fascism never would have taken hold of the world were it not for the threat of communism. It's always been supported by people as a kind of an anti-leftist position. That's where it comes from. So. And it's true in the U.S. too, I would say. You know, when the U.S. is variously in post-war period embraced fascistic ideology, it's always been done by the bourgeoisie as a kind of a means by which we fight, you know, the bad guys on the left. You know, we have to sort of have a centrally planned authoritarian structure to beat back a worse threat. It's always the worst threat. You know, the people embrace the total state for fear of something worse. That's always the way it turns out in history. Did I lose you, Scott?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's my fault. I'm sitting here talking into a dead microphone. I do that sometimes. I leave it off so that I won't be as tempted to interrupt, but then sometimes I forget to turn the damn thing back on.
I said a lot of things you wanted to interrupt. That's good.
Yeah.
What's on your mind? What do you think?
Well, I mean, you make me think of lots of stuff to try to ask you about to develop the idea further. So what do you think then about, like, Gabriel Kolko's conclusion then that progressivism, ultimately 20th century progressivism, is sort of the trick of the conservatives? It's their maneuver to fool liberals into, or the left maybe more generally, into embracing the, especially the national state, in order to carry out their liberal goals.
Right. So you have all these big institutions, but basically a big corporatist style, you know, planning coming into place in the progressive era, embraced by the then liberals, which was really catastrophic. But then after the war, there was a kind of a reassertion of old-fashioned liberalism, and, you know, you had in that mix in the 1920s, you know, figures like John T. Flynn and Gary Garrett and Abraham J. Knock and these kinds of people. What became the watershed, of course, was the New Deal, because now here you have really a systematic sort of planning mechanism, central planning, a kind of outright population control, you know, by the central state, imported directly from Italy and even in some cases even Russia in the case of agriculture. And so now you had the liberalism having to choose, you know, are we going to favor liberty, or are we just going to go all in with this corporate state? And of course we know what happened, right? You know, I followed the career of Henry Hazlitt very carefully. He was writing for The Nation magazine. His views never really changed, but he was writing for The Nation, you know, in like 1931. And he was driven out because he didn't support the New Deal. But then after World War II, you know, you really do have this kind of left-right split. And it's very interesting how essentially every election ever since has been, you know, they don't ever advertise it this way, but it's, we're basically being given a choice between, you know, between a socialist style of politics and a fascist style of politics. That's essentially the choice we're being given. And I say that not as an insult, but really as a kind of just an observation. I think that's essentially what we're doing here. We're not really given any kind of libertarian alternatives. And now, I'm sure you've noticed this, Scott, now that you see the sort of rising coherence and prominence of a sort of a consistent liberty-minded political impulse in the land, we're getting ever more attacks on libertarianism as an ideology. Have you noticed this?
Yeah.
Like every few days, you know, Salon has a big, you know, ridiculing article. Oh, stupid libertarians, aren't they ridiculous?
Yeah, you know? Well, but you know, what you're saying before that, though, I think is really what's most important, because, I mean, the truth is, well, I don't know, a lot of it is up to us to try to do something. But libertarianism is so marginal, and I think it's really true in a very important sense. But on the other hand, when liberals are just commies and conservatives are just fascists, then that mm-hmm. means war. That means no more even, you know, pretended peaceful transfers of power and just everybody vote and maybe better luck next time or anything. And now I'm not saying that's the ideal system, the American democracy, such as it's been. But, you know, like in Ukraine right now, when the toughs meet in the street and fight, they are Nazis and commies, really. Fighting it out over there in some cases anyway.
The other thing is that they both agree on the need to go to war.
Yeah.
You know, with each other and then abroad also.
Right. All right, now, I'm sorry, we got to stop and take another break, but you want to stay one more segment? Because there's more here to talk about.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, great. Hey, it's Jeff Tucker, liberty.me. Go sign up for it, would you? All right, good. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jeff Tucker. We're talking about fascism in America. And in my Twitter feed, the Austin cops just killed some guy. Just shot an unarmed guy to death. The woman who was in the SUV with him during police shooting claims victim was not armed and never got out. Cop must have seen something. No, I don't know. Anyway, so Jeff Tucker's on the line. We're talking about fascism. And right before the break, we're talking about this kind of partisanship. And I think what I wanted to say, Jeff, was something along the lines of, it seems to me like it's really fake, actually, all the name-calling fascists and socialists. Like, on one hand, we do live in a Nazi commie government-run society. There's no doubt about it. Ask all the dead Iraqis. Their piles of skulls will tell you just how fascist they really are. They're hardcore. On the other hand, we really are ruled from the political center. It's the conservative Democrats like Barack Obama and the liberal Republicans liberal Republicans like John McCain and George W. Bush who really are the extremists that rule American society. And the broad consensus among the American people is that they still want to have their regular elections. They don't like Congress or the president or whatever, but they're not really, you know, revolutionary, that kind of thing. It seems like most of the partisanship, from the birtherism to the, salon.com style, all right wingers are evil enemies who want to destroy America. All that is mostly just kind of fake and for marketing purposes by the political parties. But, you know, really, Americans aren't that bad politically. It's their leaders who are that bad, although the consequences could be pretty severe if, you know, like I was mentioning before, we have another and maybe much worse financial crisis where then people start believing this nonsense that really has been nonsense up to that point.
Well, you know, the other thing, Scott, is that there's a sense in which we're in a financial crisis. We're kind of getting used to it because it's now 6 years going.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply everything's fine.
No. But, you know, this is an important point. I think, you know, the economy is radically underperforming, you know, by any measure. And I don't even know if you can trust those crazy measures, you know, that we're we use the same method for calculating GDP that the Soviets did in the 1960s or in the 1950s when they concluded that they were about to take over capitalism as the dominant, you know, because they were growing at like 12% or something. But anyway, so who knows about GDP figures? But the point is that, new graduates from college are having a hard time getting jobs, and certainly not jobs that have anything like the promise that they once did. People are generally poorer now than they were 10 years ago. Opportunities are gradually sort of dying, and other economies around the world are growing. So, you know, you've got a kind of a slow grinding Great Recession still in place. I think the first quarter of this year, even the GDP growth registered absolutely zero. So now what's the point of this? Here's the thing. This sort of socialist fascist system that we have is not performing anymore. It's redistributing wealth, but mostly just from the people to the elites, right? And what worries me about this is that, you know, the way all the story of these kind of slow burn, long running recessions work, the way it turns out is basically you end up in a war. I mean, that's what happened in the New Deal. You know, basically the elites turned to war to kind of whip up the population. We're seeing more disgruntlement with government than we've ever seen, like ever on record, and every leader has always known that the best way to kind of deal with this is to get a war going. So this is what concerns me so much about all this latest stuff in Iraq, is that it's going to whip up the population into a kind of nationalist frenzy, turn their attention from the real enemies, which are in Washington, D.C., and, you know, get all in a frenzied state of frothy nationalism fighting the bad guys abroad.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so I'm really worried about that.
This could be the end game, you know? I mean, this is this is it. And maybe it's not, maybe it's not this year, maybe it's not next year, but you know, at some point, these kind of bad systems like we have in place right now that are unable to produce rising prosperity for their people ultimately turn to war as a way of managing and manipulating the public, yeah, off which they're living as parasites.
You know what I wonder
this is,
about
Mises
though?
Mises talks about that. Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder, I mean, it's certainly there's no question about what you're saying being historically true. And like I was mentioning earlier on in this interview, the Gallup poll shows that the American people will believe whatever the hell they're told about who to be afraid of and want to kill. Apparently, if the consensus on TV is we got to do this thing, he's a Hitler and all of that, then they'll do it. However, it seems like that kind of thing is got to be paper thin compared to, say, 2002 or 2003. Where, you know, we've been through this. It's, we didn't see this movie before, like Vietnam, where Vietnam ended a good 15, 16, 17 years before the start of Gulf War I. You know what I mean? We've just been through this. Who was I reading where they said all the hawks on TV, on CNN, are interrupted by commercials for the Wounded Warrior Project, where you two can donate to help this poor guy with no mm-hmm. legs, you know? And how, you know, I just see, and I look at how just unanimous the opposition was against the war against Bashar al-Assad in Syria a year ago. And,
yeah, there's
and
that.
I wonder
and we
whether...
have technology now, too, right? You know, you mentioned earlier that you were just looking at your Twitter feed and saw somebody killed in Austin. You know, 10 years ago, there's no way you would have even known that, right? So we've got this kind of outpouring of information going. And we've yet to see a test of our new technologies in wartime. I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, whether or not the elites can kind of hold it together when faced with this massive...
Hey, look at Gaza, man. I mean, Gaza, yeah. This is, everyone agrees across the board, no matter whose side they're on, that everything was different in the media this time.
And really?
And I think it's because of Twitter. Because
really?
Twitter is such a great equalizer between the consumers and the producers of news that, you know, when they are called out, it's not like they're not horrible, but it's just such a powerful check and balance on them.
That is so interesting. You've seen comments to this effect about the Gaza situation.
Yeah,
that
sure, because
really
you have,
intriguing.
You know, I'm following, and she's got a million followers or something, this 16-year-old girl from Gaza who's lived through three wars now and who's got these gigantic eyes like some Disney cartoon and is sad all the time because there's a freaking war going on all the time, and that's in my living room and yours and everybody's right now. And that is what they would never let me see before. A young girl in Gaza with something to say.
You do wonder whether or not this is part of what's contributing to the Obama administration's reticence, you know, in the case of Iraq right now.
Things have changed even in just the last few years. Yeah, I mean, this Iraq war will be way different in terms of the real-time flow of information coming, yeah.
I've heard speculation in the past. I'm going to talk about this Thursday night. I'm giving a class, not so much class, but I'm kind of leading a retrospective seminar on 9/11.
Oh, real quick now. We're almost out of time now.
Yeah. But, right. I mean, you know, if 9/11 happened today, we would know a lot more about the facts on the ground than we were given access to at the time.
Yeah.
Just because of the state of information.
Yeah. Well, let's hope it can make a difference. You know, I don't know exactly what can be done. I guess calling your congressman couldn't hurt.
Mm. Yeah, well. Hey, listen, if you're around, I would love to see you Thursday night, and I'll put you on camera. We can continue this. I would love to see you. It's going to be kind of an exciting
Thursday.
Class.
Yeah, that should be okay. Yeah, email
that'd
me.
That'd be great. I'd love to have you, Scott. My goodness, that'd be amazing.
Hey, the great Jeff Tucker, everybody. Liberty.me. Thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome. Good to see you. Bye-bye.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. So that was cool. I like Jeff Tucker, man. That was a good conversation. God dang old government, man. I ain't like them very much. No, sir. Not with your favorite politician in power or the other guys. Ain't like them. All right, so I don't know if this is really true. I don't know exactly how the questions were phrased. When it comes to polls, you should know that the very premise of a poll is a lie, really, that you can measure opinion in numbers or that you can make everybody fit their opinion into some very narrow category of yes-no answers or maybe, at best, multiple-choice answers as determined by these kooks who also wrote the question. So polls can be very manipulative. Polls are, by their nature, inherently just wrong. They can't be right. They can measure something, but they can't measure opinion. Only sorta, kinda, if you know what I mean. So I don't know exactly how they put it. And I don't know whether, you know, maybe they were really pushing for answers that they were trying to get or not. But even still, even if they were being as manipulative as they could, 76% of Americans support airstrikes in Iraq. Support going back to war in Iraq. Oh, only an air war, so only they die and none of our guys. Oh, well, in that case, I guess it's just fine, huh? Really? 76%? Super duper majority for going back to war. What about, I don't think so. Every time you guys say you have to have a war, it's turns out you didn't have to and the consequences are horrible. So I think also I'm going to keep that in mind for this time and no. What about that? Do you have to be a libertarian? Do you have to be some brand of conservative or liberal, right-winger or left-winger, to have that opinion? That's not the American consensus? You know what? We've had enough of this. Yeah, he's Hitler. So's Noriega, and so's Saddam, and so's the Ayatollah, and so's everybody. Yeah, he's Hitler. He rules the crappiest part of Iraq. You know, Patrick Coburn came on this show, and I don't think anybody's ever called him doe-eyed and naive about anything. And he said, oh yeah, these guys are monsters, all right, but check it out. They're such monsters, their days are numbered. They come around to the local population in Iraq, taking a census of how old everybody's daughter is. Not everybody, but they tried this in a few places. How old are all your daughters? Because we might just take them with us because, hey, you know, our guys need wives. Ha! Really? And you don't think the local Iraqis are going to shoot you to death over that? There's a hell of a lot more of them than there are of ISIS fighters. And everywhere the ISIS fighters go and kick out whatever local authority and take charge, they just put their allies from local allied militias in charge. Because they don't even have enough fighters to keep their own boots on their own ground. They only so-called hold it by telling people, you hold this ground for us, and you better stay loyal to us while we're gone. They got 15,000 men. We're supposed to believe that only America, the most powerful military in the history of the world, proportionally and, you know, per capita and actually and every other way, that only America can stop them when their enemies are the Shiite government, the Shiite Arab government of Baghdad, all its allied militias, the Iranian Persian government, revolutionary Shiite government next door, the Kurdish Peshmerga and the PKK communists, the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda guys in Syria, the so-called FSA to whatever degree they even really exist, and the Islamic Front, I don't know, they're supposedly more Nusra types. Arar al-Sham, they're called, is one of the major groups there. I don't know if they're really enemies of ISIS or not. But then, of course, the government of Syria, the government and the military of Jordan as well. And then, you know, obviously the military government of Egypt isn't going to do a damn thing or anything, but they've got no love for these guys, don't support them. And the Saudis, at least now, You know, they don't want these guys coming down to Riyadh. They want to nip this thing in the bud at this point. They took Iran down a peg like they were trying, so now it's time for the next phase. It seems like, you know, I don't know, probably. I don't really know that for sure. Maybe the Saudis are still financing these guys, the Saudis and the Qataris, although I tend to doubt that. I think they're pretty much full to the gills of U.S. weapons that Obama and McCain gave the FSA, as well as weapons that they sacked from the U.S. armed and supplied Iraqi government. They got plenty of tanks and howitzers now, so... And they've got some oil wells, and they're working on seizing Kirkuk. I think this will be the next major front in this war, will be for Kirkuk. And I guess as long as America's providing the air power, the Kurdish Peshmerga will be able to hold it. And, you know, they may have been able to hold it anyway. I don't know. But, sorry, I go off on a tangent. Here I'm trying to report a poll to you, and I get to the first statistic and start freaking out and complaining about stuff. Additional airstrikes against ISIS, 76% favor, 23% oppose. Military aid to forces fighting ISIS, 62% favor, 37% oppose. Jeez, does it matter which forces? The Iraqi army, the Badr Brigade? The Quds Force? The PKK communists who've been on the terrorist list since whenever because all the civilians they've bombed to death in Turkey? Providing humanitarian aid, 83% support that, but of course, still you got to carve out safe territory. And everybody should already know they got 1,000 guys on the ground that they've admitted to. What about JSOC and SOCOM? Do they count? What about mercenaries? Do they count? There's a report on antiwar.com today about a whole new group of mercenaries are on their way over there. Oh, was that yesterday's page? They had the mercenaries? It was yesterday's page that had the mercenaries. Contractors being hired to go over there and fight. More than 7 in 10 think Obama should go to Congress, but 8 in 10 support Congress approving military force. Man, Americans. Well, you know, I don't know. I heard on TV for like a few weeks straight that I'm supposed to hate and fear these guys, so... And again, I'm not denying they're devils. They are. They're completely out of control. I've been saying that's why not to back them on this show for 3 years straight, and I can prove it. It's all there in the archives at scotthorton.org. These are bad guys. These are suicide bombers. These are prisoner beheaders. They shot a 14-year-old kid in the face because he joked to a customer at his little fruit and nut stand that I wouldn't even give Mohammed a discount price on that cup full of fruit. And they said, what did you say about Mohammed? Bam! And shot him right in the face. That was 3 years ago. The moderate rebels. These are Al-Qaeda guys. That's who they are. They're veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The reason they're so tough is because they fought the American army for 5 years. So, yeah, they're bad guys. That's why you shouldn't have allowed... Well, not like it was really up to you. Anyway, that's why the U.S. Government, the Western government, should not have been backing them and their rebellion this whole time. And it is not why we need to intervene now. Give me a break. You know, Pat Buchanan asked one time, what if China goes full-scale war against Outer Mongolia? Because they feel like it. What are you going to do about that? You going to get in a nuclear war with China for their aggression? Or it's none of your damn business because it's none of your damn business? Oh, the greatest threat we've ever faced. Bombs away. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm trying to get Shane Bauer on the show. Oh, I think I mentioned this yesterday. He's a reporter who went to the big SWAT convention in the Bay Area over the weekend, and you can find him at Storify.com. You can find a gigantic list of all of his tweets, which include a lot of photographs and quotes and context about, well, you know, what these cops are telling each other. It's like a big trade show, basically. More to it than just a trade show, but yeah, you know, that kind of thing. With seminars and cops talking about how much fun it is being cops and whatever their problem is. So anyway, I'll show what kind of high-tech tools they have in store for you. And I'm trying to get him on the show, but he said, wait till my story comes out. All right, well, when his story comes out, instead of just his tweets, I'll have him on then, if I can. Tomorrow on the show, Adam Kokesh is going to be on to talk about not having to go to prison. Thank you, Adam's lawyer. Did you guys hear about this? He was facing some real prison time there, and they let him off on a suspended sentence. Thank goodness. Adam Kokesh, he'll be on the show to talk all about that. His trials and tribulations should be interesting. And also, Max Blumenthal is finally back from the Gaza Strip, where he's been for weeks reporting on the aftermath of Israel's attack there. Oh, yeah, that reminds me. Let's circle that and get to that. So Max Blumenthal also will be on the show tomorrow. And then... David Enders. Did he say tomorrow? What did Enders say to me? He's up here somewhere. I'm working on Roy and Enders here. I got both of them McClatchy. Enders says later in the week. Gutman says maybe tomorrow. Boy, I better write this stuff down. Gutman. I like those McClatchy guys. Gutman, he's a little screwy, but I still like him anyway. Nancy Youssef, Jonathan Landay, Mitchell Prothero, David Enders. Oh, David Enders is no longer with McClatchy. He's at Al Jazeera English now. But anyway, whatever. I like these guys. They do good stuff. I should have decided during the break what all I want to talk about. Oh, I know one of the things I decided I want to talk about. I keep forgetting to do this. I want to encourage you guys to join up the chat room. Got quite a few people in there hanging out today, having a bit of a conversation, unfortunately about John McCain, but you might have something to say about John McCain too. Well, here's people who want to hear what you got to say about it. ScottHorton.org/chat. It's a IRC free node chat called Scott Horton Show, hashtag Scott Horton Show. But you can go there in a plain old browser window. You don't need an XChat or a ChatZilla or a Pigeon or a chat this, that, or the other thing. Just a plain old browser window will do you. Fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in there. ScottHorton.org/chat. It's a nice little place some of the time, man. I like it. I try to pay attention and pick up commentary from there for the interviews and that kind of thing from time to time, too. So join up the chat room. There. All right, now, I have to admit, I saw somebody tweeted me this ironical kind of a tweet. NSA is adjusting the Apple live stream. Get excited for new spy tech. And, yeah. Hey, are you like me where your brain just come up with that quote from Michael Hayden? Where he's quoted, I think, from the Snowden documents, the classified Snowden documents, calling us zombies for walking around with these smartphones? Oh, yeah. Any American with a smartphone is some zombie idiot just handing us everything about them all day, every day. We're the living dead, he says. And we know it's true, too. You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I assume most of the time that my phone is not actually secretly activated and recording and transmitting what I say over a wire to over the air. Off to whoever. But I do know that it could be. it's really something else. It's a very brave new world. I think a lot of people are mad at Greenwald and Snowden for not changing everything, and I think they're doing their best trying to publish this stuff, but it would have taken the American people being good enough on their own rights and really saying, I can't believe this stuff that Snowden is putting out here. It must come to an end. But you know how it is. Right-wingers, man, they love the national security state. They just want to be a character on a cop show. That's all they want out of life, man. They don't mind all that stuff. And liberals, well, they're against it when Republicans are in power. But they're so damn bribed by Obama, it's so sad and sickening. I don't know, you know. I don't even need to talk about it. Your heart's breaking the same as mine. Not about Obama, but about the liberals who still believe in him and refuse to be good on any issues they used to be good on anymore. It's a travesty. But that's where we're stuck. So Snowden's revelations came out, and boy, go look at the Electronic Frontier Foundation's collection of all Snowden articles and documents. Just breeze through there for a minute and be re-horrified. You know, they're keeping all of our location data. The cell phone location data. In other words, right now, they can go back at least 5 years that we know of. And they can tell everywhere you've been and who all was ever at the same place as you. And this is a real problem, too. This is like Gareth Porter's reporting about the counterinsurgency wars in Iraq and Afghanistan based on telephone data and stuff. Basically, what ends up happening is you have these so-called intelligence people with these fancy computers, and then the computers do all the deciding. The computers are basically conspiracy theory generators, right? So if the cell phone location data says that you were at a restaurant sitting at a table, I mean, hell, they may not have a schematic of which table was facing which direction. It looks to them like you were sitting at the same table as who knows who. How do you explain that? I mean, we're getting really close to that. Whose car have you been in? Whose bedroom have you been in? I mean, most of us take our phones with us everywhere. You know, it's in your pocket, right? One time or another, or sitting on the desk. So then what happens is, based on what seems to the government like this torrent of information, it's really not information, it's just data, it's just bits. It takes intelligence to make actual knowledge out of it, and computers don't have intelligence, and you know what, a bunch of meathead steroid-pumping cops don't either. And so instead what they get is, well, the computer says, you must have done it, and you're coming with me, and we're moving more and more that way. And then, of course, no one's responsible when it's the computer's decision. I don't know, the computer says, I can't let you on the plane. Computer says, you got to go in the back room with these goons. The computer says, you're not allowed to do this, that, or the other thing. And, yeah, we're going to see more and more of that, too. But that's the one that gets me, aside from all of the, well, I mean, it's all a whole giant thing. The Snowden revelations, it's incredible. It's everything that James Bamford could have ever speculated as being possible, but not quite proven yet, you know? But that's the one that gets me like crazy, is the location data. Because who knows where you've been and who you've been next to? You don't know either. It comes down to explaining it away, because you all know in America, we all know, you're guilty till proven innocent if they've decided they want something from you or got something on you. So, you know. And also, I think, if a computer screen says that your blip was next to someone else's blip, it doesn't tell you anything other than that. But it does leave in giant gaps that can be filled in with made-up inferences by meathead, steroid-pumping, bloody-handed murderer cops. I mean, most cops have murdered somebody before, right? So, I think it's fair to call them that. All right. I'm one, too. I got a phone, and you know what? I don't care. Unless this makes it extra easy to hack me, I hope it doesn't. I have an iPhone 5. And when the 6 comes out, I'm hoping that the price will go down. I can get a new one because my volume down button doesn't work. I surely can't afford a 5.5 or a 6, but maybe I could get another 5 with a good volume button. even though I already know Keith Alexander or Michael Hayden or whichever called me a zombie for being so stupid as to carry this thing. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to The Thing. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got a lot of stuff to talk about here. ISIS news, not just me ranting and raving about how much I disagree with the policy, but here's some facts for you. Congress mulls ISIS war authorization. Obama sees no need. White House pushes for Congress to create $5 billion fund for war partners. $5 billion, huh? Maybe that's because, as they report over there at Moon of Alabama blog, the NATO allies have said, oh, yeah, no, you know what we'll do? We will help coordinate the shipment of supplies for you. That's what France and the rest of NATO are doing for the United States. Nothing. It's American Britain again going in there. So Americans got to pay the $5 billion for the rest of our NATO allies to pretend to help a little. You know, for PR purposes, it's just $5 billion. The actual amount they're going to be spending on killing people in Iraq, yeah, that's a different appropriation altogether there, I guess. A pair of competing bills have been offered in the House and Senate, which seek to authorize the new U.S. war against ISIS in both Iraq and Syria. The bills were introduced by Bill Nelson and Frank Wolf, respectively. The Nelson bill limits the war's duration to 3 years, but also rules out the use of any ground troops, which, of course, excludes any special forces, spies, or mercs, so giant loophole, but anyway. The Wolf bill does not forbid the use of any ground troops, nor does it have a time limit attached. And you know what? Any ban on ground troops wouldn't count anyway. If you authorize the war, the president gets to move the troops however he wants. That's how it works there. They know that. Damn disingenuous Democrats, like always. Obama insisted on Sunday he doesn't believe he even needs congressional authorization for the war, and already has the authorization that I need to protect the American people, he said. The White House is, however, expressing hope. And by protect the American people, he means start a war against a group that his own chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff admits is he's seen no evidence that these guys actually pose a direct threat to the American homeland. My and other paranoia notwithstanding. Certainly, there's no clear threat that needs to be preempted. And it's such an obvious argument that these guys have their hands full. Attacking them with American force only helps to make the American civilian population their enemy more. Or their target more. But never mind that. Anyway. White House is expressing they can get some sort of buy-in from Congress, so long as it doesn't need any actual authority or limit the war's escalation anyway. Obama's planning a Wednesday address. I don't really get it. Well, I guess, what, a buy-in? What does that mean? Not even a resolution. But just a nod from the leadership that we don't care, go ahead, is that it? And it sucks because I kind of don't want to say, yeah, make Congress vote on it because they'll vote to approve it. I mean, it is their responsibility and they wouldn't declare war. It would just be an authorization and they would try to pass that responsibility off to the president. Although, hell, an authorization is more than nothing. It's more than the president just saying, eh, whatever, come on, it's 2014, I can start whatever war I want. What are you going to do about it? What, Republicans are going to impeach Obama for starting a war that they want him to wage? Just, they don't want to be responsible for in case you don't want him to wage it? And then, what about this? what about if somehow we could make Congress vote on it and they all voted for it, how many of them would be turned out at the next election? Or would the next election be seen as a ratification of their decision? Because people still, I don't know, in 2 months, they're going to still be hyped up enough? Or people, could it possibly be swinging the other way by then? That Americans want to go and punish any congressman who voted to authorize the war? I mean, it sounds stupid and unfeasible, implausible, but again, 1 year ago, the American people said no to war in Syria and won. And yes, it's true, the British Parliament already said no first. And the military really didn't want to do it either. And Obama's heart wasn't really in it, and he probably didn't even really mean to say red line in the first place like that. But still, the American people were against it, seriously. And TV was left to resort to, you know, what can the government do to convince the people to get behind this thing? I remember Jake Tapper. He's one of the actual journalists in the role of anchor on TV news, you know. He's done reporting from actual wars before and stuff. He's not just a hairdo. That was his thing. Special report tonight. What can the Obama administration do to get the American people on board for this mission? Just no question whatsoever as to who's serving who and who is supposed to be bending to whose will here. Yeah, but anyway. So, you know, it sounds fanciful, but I think, you know, I don't know, maybe it could be done if the American people could somehow rally. If only, I hate to say it, but if somebody named Paul up there would start screaming and yelling and pounding his hand on podiums about this, his fist on podiums, maybe we could have a real fight about this. Does anybody know anybody by that description? I kind of feel bad. I encouraged Ron to run again in 2012, but I should have told him, don't do it, Ron. Stay in the House. Stay in the House. You'd be great on that Monetary Policy Committee. It'd be great. We'll have you commentate, an expert commentator on the election. I made the wrong call there. He made the wrong call. It's not really my responsibility, but I did tell him wrong. Because if Ron Paul was still up there in Washington, D.C., he would have so much more access to TV right now to denounce this stuff. And his son, well, he wants to declare war and go to war with ISIS. Kucinich is gone. They gerrymandered him right out of his seat. And so I guess there's Walter Jones. I saw an article about Walter Jones kind of smearing him as some kind of, you know, sissy peacenik Republican for being against the war and for saying that it was our fault in the royal we U.S. government sense for overthrowing Saddam, who he was a bad guy, but by overthrowing him is what led to this. And they did not tell the story at all that Walter Jones himself personally voted for that war. Which is, in the case of this argument, to his credit, that he changed his mind. And in fact, he got down on his knees before Jesus Christ and begged forgiveness. And got down on his knees before the families of the dead soldiers from his district and begged forgiveness for going along and doing the wrong thing. He was Freedom Fries Jones. He's the guy who said, let's stop calling them French fries. He was on board for the thing. And he's really repented. And they left that out in order to just make him sound like a peacenik. I mean, in reality, as he would tell you, it's, you know, the worst thing he ever did in his life. It's horrible. But it gives his anti-war position a little bit more weight than just, oh my God, the way they spin it. Because it was the right, I think it was Daily Caller, right-wing site for a right-wing audience. Would you believe the heresy of this Republican who would dare to say this liberal thing, supposedly? Yeah, except from, no, he's from North Carolina. He represents a heavily military district. And that's why he's anti-war now, is because soldiers are real people to him. It makes him a little bit different than the average congressman, who thinks of them much more as, you know, just useful tools and abstractions and that kind of thing. But anyway, oh, one more. Well, God, I have so much news here to cover. But, well, hell, now I don't even have time to get into that, do I? Oh, a body named the head of the Badr Brigade to be the interior minister in Iraq. That's your new unity government there. sorry, that's not funny. That means people are going to be tortured to death. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, so welcome back to the show. So, you know, I don't know. I think nobody knows really yet. Or, yeah, some people do. I don't know if I can know at this point. But if you heard all the spin today about MH17 and the conclusions being drawn there, I think they're BSing you. I'm not sure that fighter jets machine gun that plane out of the sky. But there's metal that looks like that's what could have been what happened to it. Sure does look that way. And now, you know, that could have been done after it was already on the ground, really. I don't know exactly, although I don't think anybody's really made that accusation. But if you listen to TV today, at least, on CNN, well, you know, the official report says that the plane was brought down by the penetration of the fuselage from a bunch of small pieces of something. You know, I forgot exactly their language, but that's what they're saying. Is that high energy objects? There was a burst of high energy objects from outside. Well, now CNN turns right around and says, which, you know, as we know, means a missile. But I don't know. Is that really right? In fact, hey, look, here on CNN, they have a thing that says, why does the report avoid the word missile? Well, good question. Maybe it's because that's not their conclusion. If you look at the wreckage, there was an investigator who previously said it looked like machine gun-like holes. Although that could be a metaphor, you know, if he's saying, you know, it had a bunch of holes in it like it was a machine gun. That doesn't necessarily mean he's saying, oh yeah, it was definitely machine gun fire. Maybe he's just trying to use an analogy to make you understand what the shrapnel holes looked like. You know, and it would take real expert investigators to tell you whether these holes are all from the right size and came from the right direction enough to be machine gun fire versus shrapnel from a warhead. And I guess, you know, I don't know, but I should know. Hey, does anybody in the chat room, do you guys know whether those Buk missiles are supposedly heat-seeking or radar-guided missiles? Because if they're heat-seeking, they ought to hit the engine, not the cockpit anyway. Seems kind of a strange place for the shrapnel to hit right at the nose of the plane, you know? I don't know. And, you know, really, here's what's bothering me about this. You can hear in my weasel word language, I'm full of disclaimers. I don't really know for sure. But here's what I know. The Russians held a press conference and said, look, man, here, we got radar, says there was a fighter jet, or was it two, in the sky near this plane. And then the Americans, I wish I could do the cricket sound for you, they had nothing to say. They didn't even argue about it. They didn't say, nuh-uh, here's radar footage that shows that there's no other plane in the sky. What are you talking about, footage doctorers? You know, radar report readout foragers? Nothing like that. And, you know, if you listen to the show regularly, if you were listening back when this happened, Yeah, and even right now, I'll still say, I guess, it seems like the most obvious explanation is that the rebels shot it down thinking they were shooting down a military plane. They've been being bombed by, quote-unquote, their own government for weeks at that point. They had successfully shot down other planes flying at lower levels. I think even then, there's a question as to why it was flying so low and why it was forced to fly so far south. And this kind of thing, they may have been, you know, like a Lusitania-type situation where it's not like they deliberately asked the Germans, hey, sink this American boat or this boat full of Americans in order to destroy your own best interests or something like that. But just they tricked them, basically, into giving the American war party a giant propaganda coup, which actually America didn't get involved for another couple of years, but still. The Lusitania was a huge one. Could be the same kind of thing here. And people shouldn't rule that out. You know, I forget the Russian word for it, if I ever heard it, but they call it a provocation, right? A false flag attack, that kind of thing. Yeah, that's just how business is done. You don't have to necessarily be a conspiracy theorist, but just interested in politics to see that, you know what? Yeah, man, sometimes a junta, like the group of goons running Kiev right now, if they think that it'll work and it's in their best interest, will do something like maneuver someone else into shooting down a civilian plane, lure them into it, or in fact even forge such an event in order to blame it on their opposition. And in this case, I think it's like at least it's, to me, it seems better than 51% chance at this point. Even though, obviously, the outset, the Occam's razor answer was that, hey, it was shot down over rebel territory, probably by rebels. They were smart enough to make the missile go, but they weren't quite well-trained enough to differentiate which target they were shooting at, and they hit it, but they hit the wrong damn thing. That makes sense, right? Just as something that you make up to make the facts fit a theory of some kind? Sure. But you know what? Fighter jets shot it down with machine guns is not outside the realm of possibility, I don't think, here. And if, here's one at, you can find the Google image all over the place over there or whatever. This is at the MalayMailOnline.com. MH17 investigators say machine gun-like holes on wreckage suggests missile fire. And you can see this picture of what's from, you know, the pilot's position in the plane from just outside his left hand, just outside the plane on his left hand side there. I don't know whether it's shrapnel or bullet holes. I don't have the expertise to tell, but I do know that it reeks of dishonesty when CNN pretends like nobody ever said there was a possibility that anybody had machine gunned this plane before. So there is only one explanation that could possibly fit: a Buk missile exploding and shooting shrapnel. But what about competing explanations? Well, here they go. Richard Quest from their business show on CNN International asked the question. They never used the word missile. How can this be? Oh, see, they just don't want to apportion blame. And if they say missile, then that'll mean it definitely was the rebels. It couldn't have possibly been a Ukrainian government missile. Nobody knows why not, but it couldn't possibly have been. And so they don't want to seem like they're casting judgment. Oh, really, huh? Is that just the answer? Or is it that they couldn't say for sure what sort of high-velocity objects, high-energy objects, hit the plane? Anyway, I'm Scott. I'll be right back. I got more bad news after this. Oh, I got good news, too. Scottish Secession and other things, yeah. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the off-now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. So Chomsky's got this new piece at tomdispatch.com. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but, well, he's an honest guy. I don't agree with him on everything, but he certainly has a good measure of the recent war there. And here, let me page back up, because actually what I want to talk to you about, and this is redundant, I know, from a few weeks ago and whatever, but it's a really important point, and it's something that, well, at least up until recently, I didn't know too many good places where you could read about, you know, what was really going on with Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip in 2005. And withdrawal, of course, there is in, you know, funny italics and scare quotes there, because what they did was they pulled the settlers out of the Gaza Strip. But in a sense, they were just leaving the last of the Jewish human shields there out of the way, getting them out of the way so that they could give the residents of Gaza their worst without also, you know, by proxy, you know, hurting their own people too. And so they pulled the settlers out and they turned the Gaza Strip into the prison by the sea. But now, if you ever hear about, you know, Israeli propaganda in America is unremitting on the idea that, well, you know, we pulled out in 2005 and said, here you go, Gaza's fine. Have your little Gaza Strip and go ahead and make it a paradise. And then, you know what they did? Instead of making it a paradise, why, they just started shooting rockets at us. So then we had no choice but to put them under siege. And of course, yeah, that's not true. That's not true. And so, here Chomsky says, the regular pattern is for Israel to disregard whatever agreement is in place while Hamas observes it, as Israel has officially recognized, until a sharp increase in Israeli violence elicits a Hamas response, followed by even fiercer brutality. These escalations, which amount to shooting fish in a pond, are called mowing the lawn in Israeli parlance. The most recent was more accurately described as removing the topsoil by a senior U.S. military officer, appalled by the practices of the self-described most moral army in the world. The first in this series was the agreement on movement and access between Israel and the Palestinian Authority in November 2005. It called for, quote, a crossing between Gaza and Egypt at Rafah for the export of goods and the transit of people, continuous operation of crossing between Israel and Gaza for the import-export of goods and the transit of people, reduction of obstacles to movement within the West Bank, bus and truck convoys between the West Bank and Gaza, the building of a seaport in Gaza, and yeah, that's right, they're not allowed to have a seaport. The building of a seaport in Gaza and the reopening of the airport in Gaza. End quote. He continues that Israeli bombing, of course, had demolished. That agreement was reached shortly after Israel withdrew its settlers and military forces from Gaza. The motive for the disengagement was explained by Dov Weissglass, a confidant of then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who was in charge of negotiating and implementing it, the withdrawal, that is. Quote, the significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process. Weissglass informed the Israeli press. In fact, let me just stop and add here for a minute. You might remember how this was actually a big scandal in Israel, too, that this is unilateral withdrawal. This is not part of a peace agreement with the Palestinians. This is just Ariel Sharon saying, you know what, screw Gaza, I'm pulling my guys out. And this led to the split between him and Netanyahu and led to Ariel Sharon leaving Likud and creating the Kadima Party, which is basically now just Zippy Livni. But anyway, that was part of this, if you remember the context. It's the unilateral withdrawal, and the Palestinians were not forced to accede to 1,000 concessions in order to get it in exchange, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's why Dove Weissglass is explaining, wink, nudge, see, the significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process. He didn't want to have an agreement with the Palestinians by which they withdrew from Gaza. They are trying to end the era of agreements. The significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process, Weissglass informed the Israeli press. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, and you prevent a discussion on the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem. Effectively, this is still Weissglass talking here, Ariel Sharon's man explaining. Effectively, this whole package called the Palestinian state, with all that it entails, has been removed indefinitely from our agenda. And all this with authority and permission, all with a U.S. presidential blessing and the ratification of both houses of Congress. End quote. The disengagement, Chomsky adds, true enough. Another quote from Weissglass. The disengagement is actually formaldehyde. It supplies the amount of formaldehyde that is necessary so that there will not be a political process with the Palestinians. End quote. Chomsky continues. Israeli hawks also recognize that instead of investing substantial resources in maintaining a few thousand settlers in illegal communities in devastated Gaza, it made more sense to transfer them to illegal subsidized communities in areas of the West Bank that Israel intended to keep. The disengagement was depicted as a noble effort to pursue peace, but the reality was quite different. Israel never relinquished its control of Gaza and is accordingly recognized as the occupying power by the United Nations, the U.S., and other states, Israel apart, of course. In their comprehensive history of Israeli settlement in the occupied territories, Israeli scholars Edith Zertal and Akiva Eldar describe what happened when their country disengaged. The ruined territory was not released, quote, for even a single day, from Israel's military grip, or from the price of the occupation that the inhabitants pay every day. End quote. After the disengagement, quote, Israel left behind scorched earth, devastated services, and people with neither a present nor a future. The settlements were destroyed in an ungenerous move by an unenlightened occupier, which in fact continues to control the territory and kill and harass its inhabitants by means of its formidable military might. Operations Cast Lead and Pillar of Defense. Israel soon had a pretext for violating the November agreement more severely. In January 2006, the Palestinians committed a serious crime. They voted the wrong way in carefully monitored free elections, placing the parliament in the hands of Hamas. Israel and the United States immediately imposed harsh sanctions, telling the world very clearly what they mean by, quote, democracy promotion. Europe, to its shame, went along as well. The U.S. and Israel soon began planning a military coup to overthrow the unacceptable elected government, a familiar procedure. When Hamas preempted the coup in 2007, this is the Gaza bombshell in Vanity Fair by David Rose. The Gaza bombshell is your keywords there. When Hamas preempted the coup in 2007, the siege of Gaza became far more severe, along with regular Israeli military attacks. Voting the wrong way in a free election was bad enough, but preempting a U.S. planned military coup proved to be an unpardonable offense. A new ceasefire agreement was reached in 2008. It again called for opening the border crossings to allow... Oh, man, we got to stop because of music. This is Chomsky. He'll be at antiwar.com tomorrow, unless he says something horrible at the end or something. He'll be at antiwar.com tomorrow. It's The Fate of the Gaza Ceasefire at tomdispatch.com. Very important history there. I'm glad I had a chance to read that part for you. Back in just 1 minute. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's my show. I'm going to wrap up here with Scotland and the pigs. First, Scotland. Somebody sent me a tweet yesterday to Craig Murray, who I guess is Scottish. I don't know. He's from somewhere in what soon will be the former United Kingdom. And anyway, he put out this thing about how, yeah, man, England trying to steal away all of Scotland's water rights. And a good way to fight back against that is to declare independence. And take them waters back. Will England and Scotland go to war? Stay tuned. No, I don't know. No, they won't. But the independence vote is, the polls say, is pulling ahead. Yes, on independence, pulling ahead. The Telegraph says, Scottish independence, the Queen is urged to intervene. That's right, lady, go and say, please don't do this. And so, yeah, I just think that is so cool that soon we're going to have this era where, yeah, you know, there used to be a thing called the United Kingdom. Back in history, you know, like East Germany or Rhodesia. Cool, man. And then here, oh, Cameron heads to Scotland as independence vote tightens. And so what's funny about it is that the Scottish are basically the socialists, and the government has less and less money to pay for all of their Democrat smellfare programs. And so they want to quit subsidizing everybody else. Keep as much money as they can for themselves. Find me. By all means, secede, Scotland. Which is where some of my folks are from, going way back. You could have guessed that by the name. It's also true. So, yeah, screw the English, man. Why would you want to do what the English say? Not me. I'm all for it. I'm for secession down to the last man. That's what I'm for. 7.2 billion nation states. Whatever, 0.2, 0.3 now. That's what I want to see. Yeah, no, I'm not going to talk about that. It's kind of funny, but not that important. Here, real quick. Police state news. Switzerland could grant Edward Snowden asylum if he testifies against the National Security Agency. Well, do it, man. It's Switzerland. It's fine. That's not the enemy at all. They're neutral. So, for God's sake, Snowden, go to Switzerland. If you can somehow get there without the CIA killing you as soon as you leave Russian airspace there. Anyway, yeah, that would be great, because I'm tired of all these smears against Snowden about just how in Russia he is. Yeah, well, who exiled him to Russia? Obama did. Obama stole his passport. Not under any rule of law, you understand, but just by executive fiat. He seized Snowden's passport, and so Snowden was stuck for... what, more than a month? 6 weeks or something. He was stuck at the damn airport. Was it 6 weeks? How many weeks was it, guys? He was stuck at the airport. And then finally the Russians gave him asylum, and now they've granted him an extra year of asylum, which is a fun little way for Putin to poke Obama in the eye, which is fine with me because I hate Obama, and Obama is evil. How dare Obama have his Department of Justice indict Edward Snowden on espionage charges? Really, espionage charges. Given his haul to Glenn Greenwald and Barton Gellman makes him guilty of espionage, huh? Yeah, only if you're a damn liar at war with the English language because of what an evil, dishonest criminal you are. Otherwise, no, he's clearly 100% not guilty of espionage. But see, that's what I mean. There's really no such thing as the rule of law. Not in America. Words. Right? Like America's being run by Beavis and Butthead now. Words. Words mean whatever they want them to mean. Espionage means you pissed me off and I have state power. Go to prison because I feel like kidnapping you and locking you in a cage. See, the rule of men, that's what it is. No rule of law at all. Now in Switzerland, I don't know, maybe they do have a rule of law in Switzerland. They seem to get along pretty well there. I think it would be great if the Swiss... And I don't care what he has to do for them. I don't care if he gives the rest of the documents straight to their intelligence services. The freaking Swiss. I don't care. They're neutral. Don't care. Even that wouldn't be espionage to me. Although, he already gave his haul to Greenwald and Poitras and Gellman, so I always leave out Poitras. I shouldn't. I'm waiting for the documentary to come out, ma'am. Please hurry. But anyway, I thought that was nice. I don't know whether it's going to happen, but nice that there's a possibility. You can read about it at The Independent. The Attorney General of Switzerland has concluded that they would not extradite the whistleblower if the U.S. request to extradite him is considered politically motivated. Well, of course, like I just said, yeah, espionage. He's clearly not guilty of espionage. On the face of it, it's political. They feel like kidnapping him and locking him in a cage for political reasons. In fact, I think they're perfectly happy to leave him stranded in Russia, which is supposed to discredit him, even though really, if you think about it, and this is, I'm repeating myself, but still I like it. This is a measure of what tools conservatives are. Because here's a perfect talking point for the conservatives. Obama, that traitor, guilty of espionage, as he is, has deliberately stranded Snowden in Russia where Putin can get his hands on him. It was Obama who stole Snowden's passport. Snowden didn't rip it up and, you know, renounce his citizenship or any such thing. Obama left him over there where FSB can reach out and touch him. Now, why aren't they making such a big deal about that? No, because their orders from, I guess, Rush or whoever on high, Fox News, has decided that Snowden's worse than Obama for telling them the truth about how not free they are. Snowden is the enemy, even more than Obama is the enemy, to American rank-and-file conservatives. And so they would rather blame Snowden for what is clearly Obama's fault. Because it makes them feel good to have a fun conspiracy about an American traitor who's over there working for the Russians and whatever. I guess that's easier to believe than Obama has done this because he wants to help Russia, which is the only way a conservative could say it, right? It's just too stupid for even conservatives, for even conservative talk radio audiences to pick up and run with. And if you just said, well, he did it for politics to make Snowden look bad, well, that implies that Snowden is not responsible for being in Russia, and back we go to the beginning again. They hate Snowden more for telling them the truth. Isn't that sad? Otherwise, I don't know, chat room guys, anybody, email me, tweet me. Who's got a better explanation for why conservatives never attack Obama for leaving Snowden stranded in Russia? That could be as big a scandal as Benghazi or whatever crap. Why not? I don't know. I guess because these decisions aren't made by conservative minds out here in the world. They're made in New York by TV producers and radio producers. I guess Rush Limbaugh is in Florida, right? Somebody tell Rush Limbaugh to tell conservatives to say that this is a problem. How about that? Someone suggest it to him really, really nice. Hey, here's a talking point you could use against Obama. He left Snowden stranded in Russia. It's not Snowden's fault. It's Obama's fault. And if you're friends with Rush, then go ahead and get him to agree with you. It'll be easy that Obama has darker skin than Snowden after all, so you do hate him more, don't you, Rush? You right-wing racist Klansman bigot, you. Huh? Give him a good nudge. It'll be on the EIB the day after tomorrow. Oh, and I want to say more about cops. The Washington Post did a thing all about civil forfeiture. Yes, they're 25 years late on this hugely important issue in America, but it's got so far out of control. Even the Washington Post has done really good long-form journalism here that you need to look at. Police intelligence targets cash. And New York Times actually did a good thing about SWAT teams, too. See you tomorrow.